Hey there, I'm your host Alexis Newland and you're listening to The Brave Podcast. I am so happy you're tuning in today. Each week, a friend and I get together and talk about what makes them brave. So sit back, relax, grab your favorite cup of coffee or tea, and get ready for some engaging conversation. Hey guys, happy July. We have made it to July. I tell you guys, the beginning of this year, well no, March and April felt like 6 years. And so it felt like it was going forever. And now that we're in July, I'm like, wow, the year is flying by. So it feels like there's a little bit of a more of a light at the end of the tunnel with it being summer. I don't know about you guys, but that's kind of how I'm feeling with it. Summer, I feel like life is starting to turn back into somewhat of a normal, a new normal, but somewhat normal. And so the end of this week is going to be July 4th, which is bananas to me. And we're actually going to have a fireworks show in our town. Well, not my town. We're going down to Kingsburg to go see the fireworks, which is so nice. I love fireworks. I grew up in the South and fireworks were huge. So like, I'm so excited to go see fireworks. So yeah, I'm going to be doing that with friends. And I hope you guys are having a wonderful 4th and enjoying your summer, being able to go out a little bit, maybe go outdoors, go hike, go to the beach for you Californians, just being able to get out of your house and kind of enjoy yourselves by staying and also staying safe. All right, so this week's guest is my friend Kevin Hoffman. His interview, oddly enough, kind of fits with what we're going on during this time of like racial like unrest. And so he talks about what it was like to be a Black man growing up, or a Black child growing up in a white family. And so if you've ever watched the show This Is Us, he's kind of like the real life Randall Pearson. I'm a huge This Is Us fan. And so if you've seen this show, you'll kind of relate or resonate with Kevin's story. Kevin shares what it was like growing up in Detroit and how his family, taking him in, who was a white family, moved to Detroit to a Black neighborhood so he could feel like he had people who looked like him and who were a part of him. It was really, really cool what his family did. And I think you'll really enjoy his story and how what he's doing today by going out and educating families who are thinking of adopting children of another race, of what to expect and kind of how to deal with the questions that might pop up. I think it'll be a great conversation that you guys will really enjoy. So without further ado, here is my interview with Kevin Hoffman.
All right. My name's Alexis Newland, and you're listening to The Brave Podcast. And my guest today is Kevin Hoffman, and I'll have him introduce himself and let you guys know why he's awesome.
Hi, my name is Kevin Hoffman, and I am what's called a biracial transracial adoptee. So I am the result of an affair between my white mother and Black father. I was given up for adoption immediately and adopted by a white family. And this all took place in the late 60s in the Detroit area. And I was born 2 weeks after the riots in 1967 in Detroit.
Okay. So right now you train families who are going through adoption. Do you train them specifically on kids who, if they take a kid from another race, or just what it's like to adopt a child in general?
Yes. So I am a trainer for the state of Ohio, and I train foster, adoptive parents, and child welfare professionals. So okay. Social workers.
Okay.
And I share from my story of growing up as a transracial adoptee. And then what I do is kind of share from my story and then give them the lessons that we've learned from growing up in such an unusual way.
Okay. Let's get into your story a little bit. So you mentioned you're adopted immediately and after the Detroit riots. What was it like growing up as a Black child, a white family?
Really interesting. So, like I said, I was born 2 weeks after the riots in Detroit, and it was basically the Black community finally just having enough of the unfair treatment from the white community, especially the predominantly white police force. Okay. So that's why it's happened. And so, yeah, I was literally born into a city where the races were at each other's throats. And I was a biracial kid that, you know, was born out of an affair between a white woman and Black man. And for obvious reasons, my mother's white husband made her give me up for adoption.
So he knew about the affair. Like, it wasn't kept a secret.
Yeah, because, so my white mother was married to a white man.
Okay, yeah.
And so, yeah, I mean, she actually went to my aunt, her sister, when she found out she was pregnant, and asked her sister for the money to get an abortion.
Oh, wow.
And her sister actually gave her the money. And my mother left the trailer with money in hand, and her plan was to travel from the Detroit area up to Flint, Michigan, where she was going to have me aborted. And I don't know what happened, but somewhere along that road between Detroit and Flint, my mother changed her mind and turned around and to go home and tell her white husband that she had had an affair with a black man and was going to have the baby. And that was in a time where he could have responded a number of ways,
mm-hmm.
and not many would have done anything to protect her.
Oh, wow.
I mean, this was late 60s where women didn't have a lot of rights that they have today.
Exactly.
Yes, so I'm just very thankful that she chose to do that, knowing that, yeah, he could have been, yeah, very abusive to her.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, and so she had me, and the agreement was that she would have me and give me up for adoption right away.
Wow. Did the father or your dad ever know about you?
I don't think so.
Okay.
It took me 30 some years to finally track down my father.
Oh, wow.
My biological father. And by the time I did, he had passed away. Yeah.
Oh, so I'm so sorry.
I searched. Oh, that's okay. I searched for my mother, my biological mother, back in 2010.
Okay.
Had been searching for her for 20 years. So I used a search angel. I started searching in the 80s where there was no internet. So really hard to find.
Yeah, very difficult.
And so I kind of given up for several years. And then back in 2010, a friend of mine suggested I use a search angel. And what a search angel is a person who basically knows all about searching. And their goal is to connect adoptees with biological family.
Okay.
And so, I took the advice of my friend and sent an email to this woman while I was on my way out to a football game, a high school football game.
Okay.
And I sent her this email, told her the little information I knew about my mother. And I'm sitting in the stands at the football game, and within 20 minutes, this woman found my mother.
Wow.
And it was the first time I'd ever used the internet to search.
Wow.
And I'd gone to a person who knew all about searching. So, yeah, she, unfortunately, that was in 2009.
Okay.
My mother passed away in 2003.
Oh, I'm sorry. Wow.
Yeah, interestingly, my mother and father, who'd gotten together because of this affair, they died within 2 weeks of each other.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, that was kind of creepy.
That is kind of a trip. Yeah.
And I don't think you would ask me, did my father know? No, I don't think my mother ever told him.
Okay.
I got in touch with a brother about a year ago.
So you have siblings.
Yes, so I got in touch with a brother on my father's side.
Oh, wow.
And that was the first person I was in touch with. And I had already known my father had passed away. I connected with, so he has a son, a junior.
Okay.
Who's 20, he's 20 years older than me, so.
Wow. What was it like connecting with them for the first time?
Interesting. So when it took forever to get all this information on my father's side.
Yeah.
Which says a lot about how we keep records for people of color versus white people.
Okay.
I've done family trees for my mother and father. And on my mother's side, I I just keep getting responses for about information on her side. My father, very little information. I knew he had children, but it was like, you know, I could find my father and his parents, but nothing on his kids. And it took forever to find them. And I got a number. I'd actually took a DNA test, and through that DNA test was put in touch with a nephew.
Wow.
And then that nephew actually gave me my brother's phone number because that's his father.
Yeah.
He said, yeah. Yeah. And so I called him and left him a message and just said as much information as I could to let him know I wasn't crazy.
Yeah.
And so I knew our fathers had a nickname, Pee-wee.
Okay.
And he was a cook. So I gave him that information and he called me back and said, yeah, you know, really casual. Like so nonchalant. He was like, yeah, Hoffman, I got your message. Yeah, I'm looking through everything. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. You got the right information. Looks like we're brothers. Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
Give me a call.
That is so cool.
Yeah, so I've talked to him and I have a sister who's so he's 20 years older than me and she's 24 years older than me.
Oh, wow.
And I've asked it for him to put me in touch with her, but he hasn't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's amazing. It's kind of cool. And we kind of have similar stories. I had other siblings that I had been looking for, and mine had found me, gosh, when I was in my 20s. Like, my dad had been married several times. And I had these older siblings, and I remember being on spring break going to California. I went to Arizona State at the time, and my older sister, Rochelle, was like, hey, is this Alexis? And I'm like, yeah. She's like, I'm your sister, Rochelle. And I remember being, like, elated because I knew about her, but, like, didn't know where they were, didn't have a phone number. And so she had been doing what you were doing, is she had been just trying to track us down. And so I ended up, I grew up with my little sister, just me and her, and I ended up finding out that I had like three other siblings. And so I relate to your story a lot of like how cool it can be to find that you have other family after several years.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
It's just a world.
It is. Emotion. Yeah, it really is. It really is a world of emotion. Definitely.
Yeah.
Wow. And so do you stay in touch with like your brother and like, has your family met them? And
so when I was searching for my mother, like I said, the search angel that night sitting in the football stands and she sends to me, through email, I'm on my phone looking at it. And she had sent me a picture of my mother's headstone. Her obituary.
Wow.
And so that I knew my mother had children, other children with her husband. And so that was the first time I got to see, you know, I knew I had, my mother had three boys and a girl and then me.
Wow.
And so I got to learn their names. And so since she was dead, I was really interested in connecting with brothers and sisters on my mother's side. And so it took forever now I had names though, so that was good.
Okay.
But all the phone numbers that I kept getting back with these names were all disconnected, wrong numbers. It was so frustrating. And the last number that I had was my mother's husband, and his name's Louis.
Okay.
So out of desperation, I remember sitting in my office. My wife was with me. I put the call on speakerphone and I dialed the number. And within two or three rings, he answers the phone. And I hadn't thought far enough ahead.
Yeah.
As like, what I was to this guy.
You know? Wow. I'm like anxious for you right now.
Yeah. Like, so how do you say to the husband of your mother, you know, that you're the product of an affair? Hey, how are you?
Yeah.
So I just squeezed it out as best I could. I just said, you know, I have reason to believe that your wife may be my mother, my biological mother. You know, I understand she had an affair. Do you know anything about that? And then he goes, oh, yeah, you've got to talk to my wife. And now I'm really confused. And he hands the phone to a woman. And then the woman gets on the phone, and I'm so confused because I'm thinking, man, did I get this wrong?
Yeah.
I saw the obituary. I saw the headstone. This woman died.
Yeah.
And so I'm going through the whole story again, who I am and why I'm calling to this woman, and I don't know who she is. And then I hear Louis, my mother's ex-husband, in the background say, oh, you mean my first wife.
Oh, gosh. Oh, my gosh.
So then he gets back on the phone, and I go through the whole spiel again, and then he pauses, and I can feel what he's feeling through the phone, and he doesn't know what to say, but I think it was very obvious. He was at a loss for words because I think it occurred to him that he may have to be the one to tell me my mother's dead.
Yeah.
And so he goes, well, you know, she passed away. And I said, yeah, I know. I was hoping, you know, I could get some more information, you know, about my biological father. Do you remember anything about that time? And he said, well, yeah, she went to a party and got knocked up by some colored guy.
Oof.
I was like, whoa. And so I had learned up to this point, when you're searching, you got to take what you get.
Yes.
Sometimes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it was my last hope to connect to this family. And so I took that jab and just continued the conversation like he didn't say anything.
Yeah.
And I said, well, do you remember his name? And he said, no. And I said, well, and he said, but if anybody would remember, your mom had a best friend, and I can't remember her name, but if anyone would know, this woman would. Why don't you give me your number, and when I think of her name, I'll call you. And I was like, oh, okay. And so he gives the phone back to his second wife to take my information down, and then I got to go through the whole thing with her again.
Oh.
And telling her who I'm looking for, she says, well, your sister's been looking for you.
So they knew about you.
Which was shocking because I had a long time to try and figure out what they had known. And so my sister is the closest in age to me. She's 8 years older than me.
Okay.
So I'm thinking, okay, at 8 years old, you know what pregnant is.
Yes.
And so how do you explain being pregnant and then coming home without a child? The logical answer was, well, you just tell everybody the baby died.
Yeah.
And so that was kind of what I was preparing myself for. That's what happened when I. So when the second wife says, well, your sister's been looking for you, which blew, I was actually floored.
Yeah.
I wasn't sure what they all knew. And I had just assumed they all thought I was dead and didn't know anything about me. And so that next day, my sister called me. And we talked on the phone. And she lives in the Detroit area. I live in Toledo, which is 60 miles south of Detroit. And my sister married a guy from the town that I live in now, in Toledo.
Okay.
And he had died, but she was really close to his kids. And this was the Monday before Thanksgiving 2009. On Thanksgiving, her plans were literally to drive from Detroit past my house to visit her in-laws.
Wow.
And so, on Thanksgiving 2009, I met my sister. I saw a picture of my mother for the first time and saw for the first time in my life someone who had a biological connection.
Wow.
And I had my mom, my adoptive mother, my adoptive father, my wife was there, my two boys were there, and I got to hear, you know, what it was like to grow up, you know, with my mother. Louis, my mother's husband, was at best verbally abusive, and so much, yeah, it was very rough household to grow up in, and my sister actually left the house when she was 14.
Okay.
So it was kind of a kind of a mixed bag to see that, yeah, this my sister kind of had a rough life. But then it also gave me and my mom and dad some peace that, you know, this adoption was done for the right reason.
Exactly.
Because I would not have fared well in that home.
No, it was almost a blessing.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I would have been a constant reminder to Louis.
And, yeah. When it happened. Wow.
Yeah.
And exactly. So you have brothers, too. Have you met with them from your mom's side?
Yes. So on my mom's side, I have three brothers and a sister.
Okay.
So my sister Terry and Clayton, they're really close and they live in the Detroit area. I met them. The other two brothers did not want to meet, and so I've never met them.
Okay.
And shortly I connected with the family. One of the brothers died.
Oh, wow. Wow, that is hard.
Yeah, it is. It's kind of interesting how you kind of walk through life as an adoptee where, yeah, you don't, yeah, like I had mentioned, here's a good example where, so my oldest brother, Michael, died, and no one thought to tell.
Wow. Gosh, that is
rough. So I, my mother's best friend on Facebook had connected with me and said, hey, did you hear? That was so rude. But then, good thing. My sister just recently died a couple weeks ago. She had been ill for quite a while.
Your sister, Terry?
Yeah.
Oh,
so
I'm
my
sorry.
Biological sister.
Wow.
And so, you know, it's interesting what you look for as an adoptee. So, you know, I look at the obituary. Because I wasn't in my mother's obituary.
Yeah.
Because it was like I was there. And so, And so I was just wondering, well, so will I be a part of, will they say I'm part of this family? And yeah, I was a part of the obituary, which was really cool. And then one other thing about the reunion is when I met with, you know, my sister and brother, then all these family members came out of the woodwork. Like, it was just crazy. So overwhelming.
Yeah.
And I met another uncle and talked to him once. And that was 8-10 years ago.
Wow.
And then this Christmas, I got a card. And I didn't know who it was from. I didn't recognize the name, didn't recognize the address. It was from California. And I opened a card. And there's a check in there for quite a bit of money from my Uncle Harold, who I talked to once in my life.
Wow.
Yeah, and I was speechless, and it was great to get the check.
Yeah.
But more important, I connected with him. I called him. I got his number from a niece. And I just said, man, really, I just really want to thank you for this. And I said, more than anything, just for you to... So he had explained that he was settling up his estate before he died. It's just something he wanted to do. So he was giving money to his children and nieces and nephew, and that was it. And I just said, man, what means more to me than anything was the fact that you included me in that.
Definitely.
That you included me in that. So, yeah, it's been a just a whirlwind to be connected with that family.
So I want to go back to your adopted family. So... You got adopted as soon as you were born. Do you know what made them choose you? Like, they're a white family. What was that like growing up in that? Let's get into that part of your story.
Yeah, so, yeah, my mother and father, my adoptive mother and father have three biological children.
Okay.
I have two brothers and a sister. They're all older than me. I'm the youngest in that family as well. And so my mother and father's plan was always to have four kids. They had my brother, who's 10 months older than me. The plan was they wanted to have another child, but my mother's last pregnancy was physically, was just very tough on her. So they decided to complete their family plan through adoption. Back in the late 60s, I was adopted through Lutheran Social Services out of Detroit. And according, it's my understanding that they had a rule that said, you know, if you're physically able to have children, you have to settle for hard-to-place children. So that meant that my mom and dad had their pick of, you know, medically fragile children. And back then, they were presented with two girls. One had a hole in her heart and one had bone cancer.
Oh.
Their life expectancy wasn't going to be long at all.
That's really hard.
We were living on a pastor's salary. So they decided not to adopt those two girls.
Okay.
Back then, also what was considered hard to place, and in some areas today it's still, we still are biracial children and children of color.
Yeah.
And so I was considered hard to place. So they were presented with me. Yeah, they were presented with me at a T. So back in the 60s, they would to basically find families to adopt children, the adoption agency would have a tea where they would serve tea and they would bring in all the foster kids and the potential adoptive families, and they would pass us around the room.
That is a trip.
Yeah, isn't it? So landed in my mother's arms, and the director of the agency, the Lutheran Social Services, which came over and said, boy, he'd be perfect if he was a girl. Huh. And that didn't make a whole sense to my mom.
I'm like, what? Why?
Yeah, so they followed up with her after the meeting. And my mom said, well, what did you mean by that comment? And she said, well, you have two boys and one girl. We thought you'd want to make the family symmetrical. So my mom said, no, we'd like to see if he, you know, is available for adoption. So they made an appointment, went downtown Detroit later that week, and I was available for adoption, but they had to check to see if, I was up to date on my doctor visits.
Okay.
And I was 3 months old by this point. I'd gone to foster care. I stayed in one foster home for 3 months.
Okay.
And so right there, while my mother and father are in front of the director of the agency, she calls my foster mom, Mrs. Curry, and asked about, you know, has he been seen by the doctor? Is he medically okay? What's going on? And I hadn't been seen by a doctor since I was born.
Oh, that's a trip.
Yeah. So the doctor says, well, let's do this. Why don't you go? I'll give you the address. Here's where Mrs. Curry lives. Just go pick him up. Take him to your pediatrician. And if he works out, just keep him.
Huh. Wow. So different now.
If it does, bring him back.
Yeah.
And so they kept me. And so, yeah, it was interesting growing up in this white family. We lived in a white suburb of Detroit for the first 3 years. I was a year old, just shy of a year old, and we woke up to a cross burning on our front yard.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, that was in Dearborn, Michigan, suburb of Detroit.
Wow.
Yeah, and by the time I was three, we decided that was not the community for us, and we moved into Detroit, into a black neighborhood. And from age 3 to 18, I always had connection with kids that looked like me.
That's amazing that they did that, being a white family, to keep you safe. They moved themselves to a black neighborhood. How were they accepted? Like, was it a good reception? Were people kind of hesitant? Do you kind of remember any of that?
Oh, yeah. So I remember several times my brothers being chased home by the black kids. Yeah, anytime, it's just human nature, man. Anytime there's a minority, the majority kind of seizes on them.
Yeah.
And so that happened. And so it was a tough neighborhood for them to grow up in. We lived there for 5 years. Then my dad gets a promotion and we move 2 miles away, still in Detroit, but now we're in an all-white neighborhood.
Okay.
I was 8 at that time, and that was the first time I was ever around white kids on a regular basis. I am so thankful that it happened in the order that it did, because I grew up around a great group of black kids who showed me the power of my skin.
Okay.
And showed me just like they just had, today we'd say swagger, but they just had that swagger. I wanted to be like them. They were like superheroes to me. I wanted to grow up and be just like them.
Yeah.
They taught me to some things that are just important to know if you're a person of color and you're going to face racism. And one of the best things they taught me was that, man, when people hurt you, don't let them see you crack.
Okay.
Because then they'll just seize on it.
Mm.
And so I remember that going into that white neighborhood. And yeah, and when they said those horrible things to me, you know, I showed a good face and didn't let them see me crack. And then in the end, that helped me because I had seen what happened with my brother, my white brother in that black neighborhood, when they saw him crack. They seized on him.
Yeah.
And they would pick on him. And I was taught, you know, by this kid in that black neighborhood who was like, man, he was everything to me. He's 5-6 years older than me.
Yeah.
And he was like the Don of the neighborhood. He ran things in the neighborhood. And, you know, I was this really shy kid. And when I came into the neighborhood, he took me under his wing and basically told all the other kids, don't mess with me. And they didn't. And so I was really in this protected area. My black friends had been telling me that, yeah, this is how racism is. And then, so when I faced it, you know, I just referred back to what, you know, all the lessons that I had learned from those kids. So it was tough, but
yeah.
I mean, yeah, he got through it. So all the schools we went to were 98% black.
Mm-hmm.
And so even when I lived in the white neighborhood, I would go to school and be surrounded by, you know, kids that looked like me. So I always had them to kind of, you know, if I was treated horribly in the white neighborhood, I knew I could go to my black friends and be like, yeah, man, this woman on my street, she treats me horribly, and I think it's because I'm black. Mm-hmm. And all I needed to say was, yeah, man, you might be right.
Yeah.
And that's all I needed. I just need someone to share my experience and not, and kind of, you know, validate that I wasn't crazy.
Yeah.
And they did, which spoke so much life into me.
I'm so happy you had that for you.
Yeah, it was a really, yeah, interesting kind of way to grow up.
So how did your family deal with some of the racism that you faced and also your brother faced when you lived in the black neighborhood? How did your family kind of navigate that?
It was tough. We didn't, I think initially, you know, and this happens a lot in adoption is, you know, they give you this big long sheet and it says, you know, tell us what kind of child would you accept a child with medical issues and you check mark, you know, would you accept a child of color? Would you accept, you know, it goes into all these things. And oftentimes when people are going through the adoption process, they get desperate enough to, they think if I check off as much of these check boxes as I can, I will get a kid quicker. And so I think that's kind of what went on with my mom and dad is that they wanted a child and didn't put a whole lot of thought into the impact of race and racism.
Okay.
And learned very early on that, yeah, this is going to be something that we're going to have to really pay attention to.
Yeah.
And so I think that's why they chose to move to Detroit, so that I would be around kids that look like me. You could say, and I would agree, that I benefited from my parents' white privilege.
Okay.
So when my dad got that promotion and we moved to an upper middle class neighborhood in Detroit, it was a neighborhood that my black friends, their real estate agents weren't taking them into the neighborhood to sell them houses.
Okay.
So I had benefited from the fact that I was with a white family and they got shown houses in this nice neighborhood. But my parents also sacrificed some of their privilege because they took in this child of color. So
yeah.
They lost friends. They lost access to that white community that, you know, your average white person has. You know, the church that my dad was a part of in Dearborn, they tried to fire him because
of having you as a kid.
Yeah, because they brought this black kid to the church.
That's hard to hear because the church is supposed to be welcoming no matter race, sex, any of that. But I understand, like, it's in the 60s and 70s, so things are very different. But, like, it's hard to hear that in a place of God that that's going on.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
Just, yeah.
Yeah, they went about And we're going to fire my father if the Bishop of Southeast Michigan actually had to step in.
Did he remain a pastor after this, or did he go into another career because of what was going on at his past church?
So he left. We left that church in Dearborn. He was the pastor of a church in Detroit where we lived in the black neighborhood. Mm-hmm. Then he was a pastor there for 5 years, was honest enough to say the church that he was pastor over when we first got there was probably 50% white, 50% black. Because of the riots. Yeah, it was.
Yeah.
And then because of the riots and all the racial issues that Detroit had, the white people were leaving Detroit in droves after the riots.
Yeah.
We used to call it white flight. And so that church that was 50% white, 50% black, within 5 years was largely black. And my dad was honest and said, you know, I didn't know if I was capable of leading a black congregation. And I wasn't sure if, you know, I was called to do that for them. I mean, he could have done it, I'm sure. So he kind of had really questions about that, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah.
And then fortunately, the bishop who saved us in Dearborn, he needed an assistant. And so he hired my father. So my dad got a pretty good promotion, and that's why we moved to the upper middle class neighborhood.
So what does your faith look like now, growing up in these situations and seeing racism and other things? Has this affected your faith in any way? Has this caused any fear in your life?
You know, it's interesting. We always kind of had issues with the churches that we grew up in. I didn't walk away being like anti-Christian. Mm-hmm. I was very proud that that was the base that I grew up in. You know, like the Bible says, train up a child in the way that he shall go and he won't depart from it.
Exactly.
And so, yeah. And so I was thankful for that, because when I became an adult and I was craving to get back into the church, I actually got into just a deeper relationship with God. Mm-hmm. We went to church. We were, you know, a pastor's family. But I just didn't. It's interesting. We went to church on Sunday and didn't really talk about it till Sunday again.
Yeah.
So it was exciting to see, you know, as I became an adult, that, wow, you know, you could actually live a life as a Christian throughout the whole week.
Yeah. I love that. Yeah. I know for myself, I didn't feel like my relationship with God became personal until I became an adult, because I think I just did what my parents told me to do. And yeah, Sunday to Sunday. But then as an adult, I'm like, oh, I just want to know who this God person is and to kind of decide it for myself. And that's kind of how I had a relationship with the Lord. That's how it's been since I've been 18. I kind of think it's common that as we're adults, we decide for ourselves, like, which way we're going to go. And having that foundation definitely helps.
Yeah, definitely.
So now your experiences with adoption and with racism, you've kind of turned all this stuff into good to train other people and to help them navigate this journey that you've been on.
Yeah. So, you know, it was a great experience writing the book, because very few people get to really look back on their life and kind of examine it. So I got to see what happened during my life and then give my slant on it today and say, wow, this is what I was going through. This is what I was thinking. Yeah. And initially I just thought this was a great book for the adoption community.
Yeah.
But one of the main things I did when I wrote the book was I wanted to share my experience as this person of color in this country. Mm-hmm. Because I don't think we get to hear from people of color as to how we experience everyday life.
No, we really don't.
No, we don't. And so that was very important for me to be able to do that. And I had to do it in a way where if there were white people reading it, I wasn't going to turn them off.
Mm-hmm.
And so strategic in how I wrote the book. I remember when I wrote the book, I just pictured the white mother who's raising this adopted child of color. And I was speaking to her.
Yeah.
And it took me, you know, my wife told me this years ago, but it took me 10 years to figure out, you know, this story is so much bigger than adoption and foster care. And it actually is a bigger story about race. And so that's where I'm at in my journey now. You start putting all the building blocks together in my life where, you know, my mother went to have me aborted and chose not to.
Yeah.
At the risk of her own life, quite honestly. And so why was that? And so now it's become, I have this mission or this purpose in life to really, and it gets really deep because it's this mission and drive in life to do something to reconcile the races that are a part of me.
Yeah.
And I spend a lot of time doing, you know, work to help figure out a way that we can all get along. So I work with schools, K-12 and universities. And the one thing, you know, I tell those campuses is we've got to create a way where the kid with the Black Lives Matter t-shirt and the kid with the Make America Great Again hat can coexist.
Yeah,
and get along. So it's interesting that we connected because that's where I am now, where it's, wow, there's this huge mission that's so much greater than that just comes as the result of all that I've been through. And you're like, oh, now it makes sense.
And so how do you explain racism and inclusion to kids? Because you go to universities, but I know you also talk to like elementary to high school. So how do you have those conversations with youth?
So one of the keynote addresses I do it's called Gimme 3 Feet. And what I explain to the kids is that, you know, one of the dynamics of being in relationship with other people is sometimes we all want to convince everybody else that our way is the right way.
Mm-hmm.
And I tell the kids, unless you are good friends with someone and are in relationship with someone, there are some conversations you just shouldn't have.
Yeah.
And what we're going to do is we're going to give each other 3 feet. So you can operate in your 3 feet, and it really is never going to affect my 3 feet. And we're going to respect each other. So you can vote how you want to vote, and it's not going to affect the way I vote.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can, you know, spend money in a certain neighborhood. It's not going to affect where I spend my money. You can date who you want to date. That won't affect who I date.
Yeah.
And we as adults, man, we spend so much energy trying to convince people that we will never convince.
Yes.
That are best friends. Like, it's such a waste of time.
It really is. I feel like it causes more division than anything.
And that's the same advice for adults is, man, yeah, don't get into these deep political, racial conversations with people that you're not in relationships with and you don't trust, because they're not easy conversations to get into.
Yeah, they're difficult. So for parents out there who may be facing racial conversations and dealing with inclusion, what advice would you give to them?
Now, this is something I've come across recently, which was interesting. I was recently speaking somewhere, and I was in a hotel, and the elevator doors open, and there was this little white kid, he was probably 7 or 8, standing right in the middle of the door and refused to move. And his parents were standing right there.
Hmm.
And that really sat with me for the next couple of days. And I really thought about that. And it had just occurred to me that, you know, we spend so much time, people of color, treating our kids, you know, you've got to do this to stay safe.
Mm-hmm.
When you're pulled over by the police, do this, this, and this, and this. And we spend a lot of time telling our kids, you know, how to kind of navigate in this world. And I thought, man, here's this, you know, 7 or 8 year old white kid. And already he's been convinced that the world must move around him.
Mm.
And as I get older, that play begins even more heavy for me because he should. I mean, I'm probably 40 some years older than him. He should have just respected and moved.
Yeah.
And so I thought, wow, I need to start saying the message. Not only do we need to, you know, teach our children of color what they need to do to stay safe, but we've also got to start teaching, you know, white families, don't let your kids buy into the con that the world is built for them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not. And so, and then we all kind of freak out when we see these horrible incidents where, you know, this, you know, we've had so many incidents where, you know, a rich white kid in college, you know, takes advantage of a woman. And I'm thinking, well, what did you expect? For the last 18 years, you've told him everything in this world is yours. Just take it.
Yeah.
And we got to do a better job of saying, don't let your kids buy into that con. This is especially because the world is changing and it's more multicultural than it's ever been.
Yeah.
How about we just respect each other and that, yeah, quite honestly, you as a white male are going to have some power. How about you use that to protect everybody else around you?
Yeah.
Women, color, and use that privilege. You know, you see a lot recently about weaponizing white privilege, and that's a great example.
So, Kevin, for this year, what are some things that are your big goals for this year?
To really stretch what this purpose is about and try to get out of my head that, no, that's too big, or no, that's, I can't do that. And I think we all kind of go through that where you just second guess things and you got to think, man, no, God created you. I mean, he gave you those stripes for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
And there's nothing wrong with using them for your benefit, especially if it's going to help people.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's the goal, is to really push the limits and see how far, you know, I can take the work that I do.
All right. And then what are you loving right now? What are some of your favorite things in life?
Family. Yeah. I've finally gotten to the point where I'm real comfortable with my wife and kids. And yeah, this whole corona thing has been horrible.
Yeah.
But it's also been an excuse too. Man, I've talked to my mom in this last week more than I have, you know, and she's part of that population that, man, if she were to get it, that could be kind of scary. So yeah, I've talked to her and my sister more than, you know, in this last 2-3 weeks than I have in the last couple months, which is great. I've seen my kids more. We joke around and have family time more, and they're old. They're graduated from college. So that's what I like, just enjoying, you know, family.
Yeah. And before we go, can you let everybody know what your book is called? I'm going to post it in the show notes, too, where they can find your book.
Yep. So the book is called Growing Up Black in White.
Okay.
It's available on Amazon. There's an Audible version and there's a Kindle version.
Awesome.
I did the Audible. That just came out in the last 2-3 months. And yeah, it's available Audible, Amazon, Kindle. And then my website, you can get it one of two ways, Growing Up Black in white.com.
Okay.
Or my name, kevinhoffman.com. And the Hoffman is HOFMANN.
Okay.
So 1F2Ns.com.
All right. Thank you so much, Kevin, for being a guest. It's been a great conversation. And I love your story and the impact you're now having despite all the things you've gone through. So thank you so much for being a guest.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Hey guys, thank you so much for tuning in to this episode. I'm going to put all info about Kevin in the show notes so you can find his book and find his website so you can find out more about him and what he's up to and where he's speaking. They'll all be in the show notes. And I'm so grateful that Kevin was on today as a guest and excited to possibly have him on again. All right. So my big ask of you guys. So the first one is to subscribe to the podcast so that way you get updates on the newest episodes and you'll never miss an episode. Secondly, if you want to get updates or like special, I don't know, if you want to like hear what like special things I'm doing for like all my email subscribers, you should join my email list. So if you go to apeachandcallie.com and go to the contact us link, put your email in there, you'll get on to the email list and you'll get weekly updates and you'll get early access to the episodes, which is really cool. So yeah, definitely subscribe to my email list. Finally, share the episode with a friend. If you hear something that you really thought would help another person, go ahead and share this episode with a friend. Again, thank you guys so much. I appreciate all of my listeners and I'm so grateful for everybody who tunes in each week and gives me feedback and encourages me in this podcasting thing. I cannot believe that I am still doing this. This is probably episode 27 or 28. I have lost count. So it's just amazing that this is still going and that you guys are loving it and supporting it and sharing with friends. I love you guys and appreciate you so much. Next week, we're going to talk about grief, and my friend Kate Montaun, and I hope I said that right, will be on next week. So definitely tune into that episode as we have a candid talk about dealing with grief. Thank you guys so much. We'll see you next time. Bye.